The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Gaetas, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. This case is A211675, Matthew James Belland versus Heidi Ann Belland and Polk County.
Well, good morning. And before we begin, let me just say a couple of things. First of all, thank you very much for being willing to participate remotely. We are not in the Minnesota Judicial Center, but the same rules apply to our remote arguments as they would if we were in person. And so that means a couple of things. First off, if you would state your name and the party that you represent before you begin, we are making an audio recording of this. And that way it's easy for us to distinguish when one party's argument begins and when we go back to listen to the recording. But that is the only recording that we make, and there are no other recordings permitted of today's argument. I also want to mention that when you're not speaking, if you could please mute yourselves. And I'll note that only the attorneys and the judges are able to view each other's screens and speak today. So we have disabled those other functions for other participants in our hearing. In addition, you should be able to see the clock. That's also one of the things that is visible. But we have had from time to time seen some issues. So with the advice that we give, and sorry if I'm repeating something you've already been told, but the advice that we give is that you make sure you're in gallery view and not active speaker view. And if you toggle between those, if you're in active speaker view, sometimes that clock is really small. And so it's hard to see how much time is remaining. We want to make sure you know that. So if you could stay in the gallery view, sometimes that helps. And last, I'll say that because of the nature of these remote arguments, from time to time, there are interruptions, whether it's a technical glitch or pets, doorbells, kids, that sort of thing. We understand that those things happen from time to time. We'll do our best to keep them to a minimum, ask that you do the same, but I want to make sure you know that we will do what we can to accommodate interruptions and any technical problems. Just let us know, and we'll ensure that you have all the time to which you're entitled today. And with that, attorney for appellant, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Kite, and I am out of East Grand Forks, Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of appellant Matthew Belland. And this is an appeal that arises out of a child support matter. The parties in this case have joint custody of their two minor children, and Mr. Belland is the appellant and the obligor for the child support order. Both parties also have non-joint children, and Mr. Belland specifically appeals four issues that were a part of the October 2021 child support orders. In summary, the issues before this court are whether the child support magistrate erred in determining respondent's income, erred in failing to correctly apply appellant's non-joint children to the computation, and in determining appropriate dental and vision insurance coverage and applying reimbursement for those premiums for those policies. So I'll start out with the first issue, and the child support magistrate in his order determined respondent's income using only 36 hours of work per week. And the record is pretty clear.
I'm sorry, Ms. Kite, can I jump in with two things? Did you say 36 hours instead or 32?
36 hours, I believe it was.
Okay. And then the second, go ahead.
Prior order, it was 32 hours. And in this order, it was 36 hours.
Okay. And then the second question, before you get too far into the argument, is do you have at the top of your head or ready, where I can find the child support magistrate's worksheet that was attached to its order?
You know, I don't believe he had a worksheet. He did it in the order. I don't believe he attached a worksheet to this one. So if you would like, I mean, I could compute it and provide a PDF of the computation as he did it. But I don't believe I know, in fact, that he didn't have an actual worksheet.
Yeah, I didn't see one provided. And so I was curious if there was one that I just missed. But you're saying there wasn't one attached. So I think that answers that question. Go ahead.
Okay. So Ms. Rylander previously worked 40 hours a week at her same employer through Altrue as a certified medical assistant. She was hired to work 40 hours a week. She voluntarily switched departments and positions to then go down to 36 hours a week several years ago. And in the initial part of the divorce, there was an interim order that actually determined that she was voluntarily underemployed from that transfer. And so, you know, respondent never appealed that. And now her argument is simply that, you know, she doesn't have 40 hours of work available or that she's full-time employed. But, you know, the record is clear that not only does Altrue offer positions that have 40 hours a week for her same skills, but other places do as well. And she really has made no showing that that's the industry standard. In fact, the Labor Bureau and statistics shows otherwise. So unless you guys have any other questions on that part, I guess I will move on to the next one. The other part of her income that we're arguing is there was a stipulation for extracurricular expenses. And initially, the parties agreed that it would be 50-50 equal responsibility for agreed upon expenses. And then they stipulated to it would be $75 a month reimbursement for agreed upon expenses. And then the district court judge, not the child support magistrate, entered an order saying that it'd be $75 a month, no matter what, until the children turned 18 or graduated. Well, subsequent to that, and maybe there was some intermittent things here going back and forth with these orders, is that the child support magistrate has, in the last two orders, held there's no deviating factor. And in order to deviate, you would have to go through a process to make sure that it's something that the obligor could afford. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't know what this court wants to do, but respondent is receiving $75. Appellant is not. Like, it comes in his paycheck and then he provides it to respondent. So essentially he's double paying. They're counting it as his income, not hers. And there's several ways we could argue that it should be income regularly received for respondent. It could be child support deviation. It could be spousal maintenance, you know, and respondent pointed out that there is no spousal support maintenance. And I agree with that, but at the end of the day, she's receiving that money. And so either this court needs to uphold and say there is no deviating factor, she shouldn't be getting that money, or we need to count it as her income because she does receive it every month. The next issue is Mr. Beeland's non-joint children. So he has a child support order for a non-joint child that was entered by the same child support magistrate. That was brought through public assistance through the county, and the hearings were supposed to be set at the same time so that the court could make sure to apply all the same factors. So they wouldn't be changing one because they both rely on the other one for his child support obligation for the other child or children. And so in this case, the child support magistrate just did the non-joint child based on the hypothetical obligation, but he actually has an actual court ordered obligation that he's paying. And so the whole point of using a hypothetical obligation is when you don't know, but here we do know. And that's factored based on both parents in that case, their income, childcare, and a lot of factors. And so, you know, I think he was looking at the wrong statute and didn't apply the correct one. Then he has another non-joint child, and that child was a foster care child that he had a legal obligation to provide for, and then it was moving into an adoption. The child wasn't adopted yet, but he still provided information to show that he was legally responsible for that child. You know, he provided his tax return. He claimed him as a dependent on his tax return. And he provided he provided a response to the child support officer saying he had legal responsibility of that child. He provided a brief on it. And respondent made no arguments otherwise to the child support magistrate. It's only now that she's saying conclusively he didn't have a legal obligation for this child when in fact he did. And so that
is there anything in the statute that gives us some guidance as to what legal obligation might look like, or what might constitute having a legal obligation?
It really does not define it very well. I think that's a great question, but I will note that the child is living in his home. It wasn't foster care, subsidized, or anything like that, because it was two different states and things like that. So this child was just legally placed in his home and in his care and working towards adoption.
So what was, when you say legally placed in his care, but he wasn't, but he, okay, so is there any legal proceeding or court order that they obtained, or was this more kind of an agreement between the two of them?
Right. It was an agreement at that time working towards adoption. So there was no court orders at that time.
So agreement between whom? Between the mother and the appellant?
Correct. The biological mother, yes. And so there would not have been an order at that time. No.
So it seems like the key here is at what point did the legal obligation move from maybe an informal agreement to a legal obligation? And trying to look at the most applicable language in the statute, there is a provision in 257.54 regarding how a parent-child relationship can be established. And at paragraph C, it says an adoptive parent may be established by proof of adoption. So it seems, as I look at that the statute contemplates a completed adoption proceeding in order to be to have that legal obligation. Is there some authority that you're looking to, or you're asking us to look to say that obligation starts before completed obligation, or something other than proof of adoption?
No, I'm not asking you to look at any specific authority. I don't think that there is one other than filing taxes in the IRS tax code, and foster parents are able to claim their foster children, and that would be the closest thing I found. But certainly there's other, laws where parents or guardians or anybody taking care of a child can be held responsible for that child's actions or payments or even child support, essentially for a de facto parent. And so there are a lot of laws where one can be considered a de facto parent, but it's more gray. There's nothing as conclusive as what you're asking me for. And the third issue is whether the child support magistrate erred in determining the appropriate dental and vision coverage policies for the minor children. So this is kind of a complex issue, because initially the parties stipulated that Mr. Beelen would provide the medical and vision, and Ms. Rylander would provide the dental through her employer at Altru as long as it was available. It's my understanding that that's because that was a better or cheaper policy at that time. So when Ms. Rylander remarried, she never notified him that she got a new policy or new coverage. And in fact, he found out when he brought him to the dentist that they weren't covered anymore. So he then obtained a policy, and there was an appeal previously on this and many issues. And I think that was just about the PICS percentage reimbursement. And at that time, it was really unclear. Like, he didn't know where this policy was coming from. All he knew was that they didn't have it and he needed to get insurance for them to not have to pay bigger dental bills. And so then the child support magistrate in the 2019 order ordered him to continue providing this policy. So now here we are, and we've got Ms. Rylander with a policy she won't provide any information on to determine whose is more appropriate, and Mr. Beelen still being ordered to provide his a little more than $85 a month. Well, if Ms. Rylander's is better and it's free, then maybe it should be the ordered one, but we don't know that. And so I don't know how the child support magistrate can determine hers is primary and at the same time order Mr. Beelen to continue providing his when it's
costly. It costs about $85 or $89 a month, something like that. And so at this point, with the information we have, my argument is that Mr. Beilens should be ordered primary. And if it does get remanded and revisited, then we need to see the policy information and release Mr. Beilens from having to provide it at all if Ms. Rylanders is in fact better. But at this point, I guess the argument is, why force him to provide it? He doesn't have the information on the other one. We just don't know which one is better. I think there needs to be a deeper analysis into that.
So it seems like there's two potential different questions, and I want to make sure I understand those distinctions and understand what was argued below, so I know what how it relates to what you're saying now. One potential argument is that these parties needed someone designated as the primary dental provider, or which parent is going to be responsible as the primary parent for dental coverage. That's one potential argument that seems like that was the issue below. There's a separate argument about how does the child support magistrate choose between different potential insurance coverage policies, and whether or not the order that we do have is sufficient to support choosing one parent's policy over another. In other words, what's the appropriateness of the policy? And I'm not sure that was specifically argued in the way that it seems like it is now on appeal. So I guess the question I have is, what was presented to this child support magistrate? Because it seemed like the argument below was asking the child support magistrate to just determine who's primary. And the appropriateness is something that you would get to down the road. Once you have a designation of who's the primary, then you can address in a separate motion whether that primary policy is sufficient.
Well, I can tell you, I did argue it in the brief that I submitted the day of the hearing, and I did argue it at the hearing, the appropriateness, and that she did not provide any information to determine that hers was appropriate to be ordered or ordered as primary. I did argue that, and I argued it's Minnesota.
I see that, but it seemed to me that that was the support of the request that Mr. Beilens be named the primary, not in support of a request that Ms. Rylander obtain a different coverage policy or do something different in her coverage, right? Those seem to be two different requests. One is because hers is not as sufficient or as appropriate as Mr. Beilens, you should pick him as primary. That's different than saying you should order her to have a different policy.
I see that my time is up. May I respond to your question?
You may. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. I think you have an accurate understanding of most of that. But the where I'm coming from is that, yes, we can't even argue whether or not to get rid of Mr. Beilens, I think, is the other option. Not what Ms. Rylander should do. I mean, I think, you know, if she obtains it, that's one thing voluntarily. But where I'm coming from is I think that we can only argue his is primary just because we don't have her information. But if we did have the information and hers was more appropriate, then the next argument is, why should he be required to pay for it? We need to analyze whether it would be beneficial or just a waste of money for him to be providing that every month. And so the argument was never what she should do with her insurance, but the only argument I can make with the information I have is that his should be primary, and perhaps maybe on if it gets remanded or at a later date, a motion to modify it to change hers or his or something like that. But I just don't have that information when she doesn't provide it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Sullen.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Denise Soland. I am the attorney for the respondent, Heidi Rylander, in this case. There are several issues that the appellant has gone through, and I would try to go through them as they are in the brief. The first is whether or not my client is underemploying herself. I have been her attorney since the parties divorced, and so I have a little bit of an understanding of what has transpired over the years regarding child support. The parties, when they were married, she was working 40 hours per week, but they divorced in 2015. That position that she changed to go to 36 hours per week and then later on dropped to 32 during COVID was something that she did in 2012 when the parties were still married, when Mr. Beland, as her husband, agreed that was a good transfer, a good change for her. So since the party's been divorced, she has always been working less than 40 hours per week. And she works for Altru Hospital in Grand Forks, and she's been doing so for 20 years. So as a certified medical assistant, and the statute 518A.32 subdivision 1 indicates that 40 hours per week should be used except in those situations where employers, due to custom, practice, or agreement, would use something less than 40 hours per week. And certainly the medical field and my client's positions particularly is something that is less than 40 hours per week. Her position does not offer for 40 hours per week. In fact, Ms. Kite subpoenaed Ms. McCoy from Altru Resources, who testified that they consider my client full-time at 40 hours per week, that she did not know whether Altru would offer any certified medical assistance more than 40 hours per week. And so when we're looking at whether she could work more hours, we are looking at a situation where, as my client testified, she would essentially have to quit her job and reapply for possibly another position in Altru or another position in Sanford, which is the other medical facility offering positions in Grand Forks, in order to be working full time. My client has indicated
Can I ask a question about the argument you're making? Because as I'm looking at the statute, I see that for computing potential income or imputing income, one of the methods is to look at how much an income a parent could earn working 30 hours per week. And I wonder what impact that has on the argument here. If that's one way to impute income, then isn't that something the child support magistrate could do if it decided that we're looking at something less than full time here, and that would be income that's less than the actual income, right?
Right. And if the child support magistrate, we're going to find that after looking through, listening to the human resources testimony, listening to my client's testimony, looking at the arguments, that the child support magistrate believes that she was voluntarily underemploying herself, the result would be that he would have to impute that additional income to her up to 40 hours per week in order to run that calculation. That's not what the child support magistrate found, and none of the evidence points to the fact that she is voluntarily underemploying herself. To voluntarily do that, she would have to be offered 40 hours per week and not take that position, not take those additional hours. The only time she said she could take 40 hours per week is if somebody called in sick and perhaps she could pick up some additional hours, which is not consistent in order to run a child support calculation. In fact, the case that was cited by counsel, the Karen case, which indicated that, which imputed income, is not the same as this case. This case is distinguished from that case because in that case, the registered nurse testified that she was a part-time employee, only working extra hours when she was mandated to do so, that those extra hours were available to her, but she wasn't taking it. Where this case, that is not the case. If there's any more questions about the imputed income, I guess I can move on to the next issue, if that's okay. Another thing that they've talked about when it comes to income is this. Oh, sorry.
Yep. I just have one question. You said that it dropped down during COVID. Did it not come back then?
It hasn't come back up officially yet. She was reduced to 32 hours. Well, it wasn't at the time of child support. I guess I didn't ask her as of today, but I think it was reduced to 32 during COVID. But for a while, she was working 36 hours. One of the things that the appellant has claimed is that there she should be $75 per month should be added into her income. And if the court looks through the record, the court will find that when the parties divorced in 2015, they agreed that any extraordinary expenses for the children related to activities would be shared equally between the parties, something above child support, something above food and clothing, everything that they, because the kids are very active. They're in hockey, they're in dance, they're in some things that are really expensive. And so when they divorced, they decided we're going to split those extraordinary expenses equally so the kids can continue to participate in those activities. Then in around 2018, the appellant said that he can't afford to do that anymore and that the kids would not have to be able to go to those activities. So the parties went to mediation and came out with an agreement that my client would bear the brunt of those expenses. She would pay all the extraordinary equipment expenses and the fees to join hockey and dance. And he would only have to pay her $75 per month as his portion, which is significantly less than 50%. And it was a deal for him to do that. She did that based upon the fact she wanted her children to continue to be able to participate in those activities. Now, this case, this issue has been litigated endlessly in the district court. He has tried not to pay those. He's been was found in contempt for not paying that $75 a month to her. He said it was only going to be in the months when the kids were participating in activities, which is not the agreement. And the district court has ordered him to pay that. Now he's coming back to the child support and trying to get around having to pay those activity fees again. And so if the court looks at the 2018 stipulation, the court will find it was not designated as spousal maintenance. In fact, the parties have waived spousal maintenance in their divorce, and the court is not, and the court is divested from any authority to impose spousal maintenance on either party. As for the issues of the non-joint child, at the time that the county brought the child support motion, that was based upon the petitioner's request, by the way. He had no legal obligation to support any non-joint child. At the time that the motion was made, the appellant was living with Ms. Kite, who is his now wife and also his attorney, raising their joint child together. But there was no child support order specifically in place. In fact, if you go through the transcript, you will see that there was a lot of discussion back and forth about a lot of testimony about the child support order that was eventually ordered in Ms. Kite, Mr. Beeland's child support case, because it was something that was stipulated to by the parties, Ms. Kite and Mr. Beeland, and is significantly more for one child than my client receives for her two children. So essentially what happened in that child support case is they came in, they stipulated to an extremely high amount of child support for one child. And then when we go to my client's case, he tried to argue that because he's paying so much to Ms. Kite.
Ms. Solon, I think I understand that argument. The question I have is about something you said earlier. I was under the impression that that child support order, or as you put it, the one that's extremely high for the one non-joint child, that that was already in place at the time of the motion or at the time of the hearing. Is that right?
It wasn't at the time that the motion was filed. It was under advisement at the time that the hearing took place, I believe. I didn't have specifically a copy of that court order, but I think if I recall the testimony, that it was something that the court was going to issue an order on, or that the parties had stipulated to, so we knew what the amount that they stipulated to was going to be. So that was part of the discussion.
Okay, so are you arguing that at the time of the motion, because there was no order yet, that there was no legal obligation at all? Or are you saying, again, because we have the hypothetical and then we have the actual, right? And so I understand that for the child whose initials are CB, that that's a different argument. We're just talking about LB at the moment. And so maybe you can clarify, are you saying that because the motion, at the time the motion was made, there was no order that was sufficient to establish Mr. Beeland is legally responsible for LB either?
Yeah, that was part of it. But the time the motion was made, because the transport magistrate can issue a decision based upon the information he has before him at the time the motion is made. That was part of our argument. The other part was the way that the child support was calculated between Ms. Kite and Mr. Beeland. We asked for a downward departure based upon the fact that my client really didn't have a role in that. There was no way, I mean, her income wasn't even looked at as part of that child support calculation. And if it was going to be used to reduce my client's child support in any way, that it was fundamentally unjust and unfair. And so we talked, there was a lot of discussion about that as well. As for the other child, the one that they were in the process of adopting, CB, the arguments, I guess the questions that this court has asked Ms. Kite in relation to that is basically the same argument that my client has, that there was no legal obligation for Mr. Beeland to support CB at the time of the motion or at the time of the hearing.
What is the impact of him claiming CB as a dependent mean? Does that have any impact on whether there's sufficient evidence to establish he's legally responsible?
Well, if he's claiming CB as a dependent on a tax form, it could be that the mother has voluntarily allowed him to do so, and they have a private agreement, but that doesn't constitute a legal obligation for him to support that child. It's just a private agreement.
Let me understand. Is there a petition for adoption that's been filed?
As far, we're not really part of that proceeding, but as far as my client is aware, he has not adopted that child.
That's not my question. Is there a petition that's been filed to adopt?
I don't know that. Maybe Ms. Kite could provide that since she's one of the adopting parties.
Is there anything when you file a petition that requires you to assume a certain support obligation until the petition is completed?
I don't have that information. I know that at the time that the hearing took place, that adoption, they were looking to adopt it by private agreement and no legal proceeding had taken place. And again, that information, what happens during the adoption is information my client receives either through the argument that we had at the child support proceeding or that the children say that they're going to be adopting a baby. It's not something that we're a party to, so we don't have the specific information to provide the court. Certainly, if Mr. Beeland, I guess that's another point, if he was going to want to prove that he had a legal obligation, he should have been submitting that information to the child support magistrate, copy of the petition, copy of an order, some kind of formal agreement saying he had a legal obligation to support the child, and none of that took place.
Nothing would preclude Mr. Beeland from filing a new motion to modify once the adoption is complete, right?
Correct. I just want to quickly get to the healthcare issue. It is somewhat of a big deal between these parties.
Can we talk about the other child? Is it LB? What did the magistrate do about that? Anything?
What did the magistrate do about LB?
The magistrate said, well, this was a stipulated amount. So did the magistrate then just ignore it?
My client and Mr. Beeland each had a child. And so they're on the child support calculator. They received that non-joint child deduction instead of a specific child support amount deduction.
One of the things that's troubling to me is that I don't see the worksheet, so I don't know what the magistrate did. And you're not sure there even was a worksheet. Was that your statement earlier?
That wasn't mine. That was Ms. Kite's, but I don't believe there was one. I don't believe there was. That was something the party stipulated to during the hearing, that each party had a child, that they should be receiving that non-joint child deduction. But I think what Mr. Beeland was requesting was that the child support magistrate use his actual child support to help reduce his child support to my client, the one that he had stipulated to. And I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance to go to the health to the issue, and I see I'm out of time, the healthcare one, but we just want to point out that he's already appealed this in court file A20-1070, and the child, this just the Court of Appeals has already addressed the issue of dependent healthcare coverage as one of the issues before the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kite, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I just want to go back to the insurance, and Ms. Solon talked about the prior appeal case, and I just want to point out that in the prior appeal, I was not a part of that case, but from my reading, it appears that it was based upon some information that we have different information today about Ms. Rylander's insurance and whether or not Mr. Beelen voluntarily obtained it. And my argument today before you is, should he have to continue providing it without PICS reimbursement or without the ability to drop that insurance? Just because this court previously addressed whether PICS reimbursement was appropriate at that time for that appeal over a year ago. For example, Ms. Rylander switched insurance to her new husband's insurance. What happens when Mr. Beelen wants to do that, or if he can do that, or if it's cheaper? I mean, should he be held to that forevermore without ever being able to readdress this? And it seems to be Ms. Rylander's position is he needs to pay it because he obtained it at one point in time, which is a good thing for a parent to do, and never be reimbursed for it and never be able to drop it. But when it comes to her, she's able to drop insurance in violation of court orders and get new insurance. And so I guess I fail to see Ms. Sullen's point on the prior appeal.
Well, it seems to me that the prior appeal did a couple of things. First off, it made it clear that the CSM was not required to follow subdivisions 3.1, 5A, or 5B in its analysis. And I think that that would still apply today, because the reason for that decision was that this was something the parties agreed to, and Rylander then voluntarily supplemented the dental insurance. So it seems like that still exists, and I don't know why we would come to a different conclusion on that point. But it also seems that in that decision, the method or the mechanism for father, for Mr. Beeland, to then require, if insurance were to change, the mechanism would be to make a motion and argue that the coverage that mom has, that the current policy Ms. Rylander has obtained is insufficient, right? And I don't think that's the request below. So I do think that there's an impact to what we can and can't review based on that previous opinion.
Well, in response to that, what the appellate court and what Ms. Sullen and Ms. Rylander were stating at that time was that it was voluntarily obtained by Mr. Beelen. And at that time, he did not even know that she did not have the all-true policy, which she could not drop without them agreeing on a new policy. And now it's clear that she had a new policy, that she switched over to it then, and that's what she has now. And he filed a motion to compel to get the information, and the motion to compel was denied. And the child support magistrate says we can do testimony, but we still don't have that information. So he's stuck because he can't get that information to make the motion you're talking about. So I think there is.
Did you note as part of this appeal the issue of the magistrate not requiring the respondent to provide certain information?
As a part of this appeal?
Yes.
Well, the bigger point that I pointed out in the appeal was that...
I don't want a bigger point or a well. I want to know whether you noted this as an item of appeal that we are to address, because if you didn't, then we shouldn't be spending much time talking about it.
No, I did not address whether or not she was required to provide it in the motion to compel. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. And so I have a motion to strike and a motion for sanctions, because a lot of these arguments brought by Ms. Rylander were never raised to the district court. It's really tough to argue for the first time on appeal about facts that were never alleged, never brought up, legal arguments that are sometimes contradictory to the arguments she's made before, whether to the district court judge or to the child support magistrate. So I have a few seconds left, and I just wanted to note that Ms. Rylander's employer even states that she's not employed on a full-time basis. She did not have to switch over, or she did not have to quit her job to get reduced hours before, and she basically would not have to quit her job now. She can be upheld to 40 hours and continue to work 36 hours. But the point is that that's a mandatory provision, and this court is supposed to uphold what the child support provisions say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement.